By pushing your boundaries, you're really becoming a better person, a next level person. Just like when you're in the gym and you cannot do this weight, and then the next time it becomes easy. Courage is a muscle and it needs to be practiced every day. And what did conflict consist of essentially is going out there and confronting yourself to pain and discomfort in a productive way. Pretty much everything that you need to achieve, it will be there along the way as a needed step.
Welcome to Brave. Learn from Southeast Asia's best tech leaders. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. No BS on success. I'm Jeremy Au, venture capitalist, serial founder, Harvard MBA, science fiction nerd, and dad of two daughters. Every week, we debate startup news, interview changemakers, answer listener questions, and share personal insights. Join our movement of over 40,000 members and get transcripts, resources, and community at www.bravesea.com. Stay well and stay brave. Grain is an online restaurant that serves healthy yet tasty meals on demand and catering. They are backed by investors including the Lo & Behold Group, TE Tia, Open Space, and Cento Ventures. Their meals are thoughtfully created by chefs with wholesome ingredients. For the month of April, Grain has teamed up with HGH Maimuna to bring you a quirky yet delightful experience for the first ever Michelin-inspired catering in Singapore. Learn more at www.grain.com.sg. If you ever need to feed your teams or family, go check out Grain. Hey, Maxim, really excited to have you on the show. You have quite a set of experience across Southeast Asia on so many name brand kind of like tech companies that are real startups, and you are off to build your own. So really exciting story to have here. Could you share a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeremy. So yeah, Max, I'm French initially, but I've worked mostly around the world and especially in Southeast Asia and back for the last few years. I'm currently based in Australia building Upworth, a fintech startup I co-founded. But before that, after some, you know, MBA and working in private equity and strategy consulting, I joined the startup world with different Rocket Internet ventures. I was at the early times of Jumia Food, so the Grab Food or Uber Eats of Africa that was listed on the NASDAQ. In 2015, that's how I started my career in startups. And then I moved to Southeast Asia after strategy consulting as MD of Zen Rooms in Kuala Lumpur for the Malaysian market. And then I was in Jakarta for Flash Coffee as MD for Indonesia and grown for the last 2 years before moving to Upworth, the company in Indonesia.
Amazing. So could you share a little bit about how you rotated into Southeast Asia tech?
Yeah. So look, I mean, after my first experience in Rocket Internet in Africa, so I was in Algeria, North Africa, I really loved the environment, mostly like the people with whom I was working, super dynamic, young, motivated, smart, and we were really having crazy growth, taking over the market in a few months. There was really a lot of adrenaline and a lot of learning since such a short amount of time. I was like, okay, this is the type of thing I like to do. I want to do more of that. I want to learn more and I want to grow businesses from scratch to, you know, as to become like successful and have big impact on people's lives. So when I checked at what were the profiles of the people that were leading these Rocket Internet ventures in Africa on this, it was mostly private equity and strategy consulting. So I was like, okay, you know, when you want to go somewhere, look how are the people that come back from there or that are already there. So yeah, when during my MBA, I worked for a private equity mid-cap fund in Africa called Adenia Partners. And then upon graduation, I joined Roland Berger and Strategy and two strategy consulting firms as well in West Africa, actually in Casablanca, which is basically the hub for Francophone Africa. And always be, you know, I've been exposed to emerging markets that way. And there are many similarities with Southeast Asia, also with many fast-growing emerging markets as well. So I was, while doing strategy consulting, I was always on the look for the next step, which was basically getting into Rocket Internet or a fast-growing startup in an emerging market. I had the chance before to have been exposed to Southeast Asia during my degree when I was working for 1 year in Vietnam, actually. 6 months in Hanoi, 6 months in Ho Chi Minh City in 2014 before graduation. And so I was following closely the startup ecosystem in Southeast Asia. And so when there was, I saw an opportunity in Zen Rooms. And yeah, actually Zen Rooms was a company that I really had noticed earlier. So when you really love a company, just go out there, speak to the people. So during my MBA, for the small story, I actually did my mini thesis of MBA on a business analysis on Zen Rooms. So this was actually 2 years before joining Zen Rooms. So I had already spoken with some management of Zen Rooms. I had done my thesis on it. I had spoken with some of the players, but they were actually at this point, they were pre-series A, so they didn't have enough funds to welcome new management low-level people in the business. So I was like, fine, let's keep in touch. I went into consulting. And then when I saw they were recruiting a new MD for Malaysia late 2018, I reached out, right? And I managed to get the job, partially because of my relevant experience in Rocket Internet, strategic consulting, private equity with the MBA. And I guess the fact that I had shown my interest already in the venture 2 years earlier.
So talk about Zen Rooms. What was that experience like? Because at that time, Airbnb was hard. But could you share more about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, it was really a fascinating look. I've seen both sides of the picture here because I joined late 2018 until basically for 2 years until late 2020. So I saw the crazy growth and I saw the crazy, I don't know if degrowth is even the term, I think basically earthquake period of COVID for the hospitality sector in general and hospitality tech in particular. So, I mean, Zen Rooms was really a really cool business and trying to indeed, you know, basically working to build solutions for small independent hotels across Southeast Asia and different types of solutions with different degrees of integrations. So there was actually like a franchise chain-like system, like let's say the Ibis hotel, let's say from Accor, but you build it in Southeast Asia with existing independent small-scale hotels, right? So it was across several markets in Southeast Asia, was in charge of Malaysia. So that was the first piece. But there was obviously a view beyond that. So we're having different models, as I said, from like almost from full integration to very light touch. So what is full integration? Is we're actually managing a few hotels ourselves. Like we were taking the lease and managing the entire operation, the entire team, the entire system, doing the sales. So doing basically everything. So we had a few hotels like that in Malaysia, and we had also a few Airbnb. So, you know, KL is a very hot spot for Airbnb traveling. So we are taking like 10, 20 units in condos and running them ourselves like a hotel, basically. And yeah, it was working super well in Malaysia and other markets in Southeast Asia. But that's the maximum integration. But of course, you cannot scale that. It's not that scalable because it's capital intensive, right? And it's not also where you can bring the most value at scale with tech, as a tech business. Then we had the franchise model, in which we are actually like providing the management softwares for independent hotels that were, you know, used to work pretty manually, with or without a brand layer. So either as a white label for them to just, you know, run the operation from a tech perspective, from the system perspective, or on top of that, we could add basically the branding. So the Zen Rooms, you know, logos, pillows, and all the basically part of the customer experience from a B2C perspective for the hotels, right? So the consistency, you know, hotel chain, basically the consistency of the experience for the end users. And we're also building an OTA actually for Southeast Asia. So the equivalent of booking.com, let's say, but for Southeast Asia. And we're actually the first OTA in the Philippines. So yeah, so it was also pretty successful. And then, yeah, finally, we are doing basically on top of the franchise, both with the branding or without the branding, we were helping hotels to sell online. So we had our own algorithm and teams to do the yield management, just like, you know, you do it for airlines. So yield management for hotels. So it was something that hotels were not doing in the past and that we basically introduced to the small independent hotels in Southeast Asia, 1 to 3 stars, and then, you know, mostly from 5 to 100 rooms. So yeah, so that's what we're doing, was growing very fast. Yeah, was doing well. Obviously, the world travel in Southeast Asia was growing as, you know, globally as one of the most exciting regions to travel, discover new cultures, have access to great food and locations. But yeah, COVID happened, right? Actually, from beginning of 2020, with heavy dependence, especially in Malaysia, on the Chinese market. So the heat started at the beginning of 2020, right? And then obviously with COVID, the lockdowns in March and the rest of the story was super, super hard for the hospitality industry and for us. So we actually had to obviously fire a lot of people, close a lot of operations, stop operating our hotels, not immediately, but over a period of time, because at the beginning, we're obviously trying to leverage the things for, you know, health workers and things like that. But, you know, it has a limited timeline. And also, yeah, you cannot keep your entire portfolio for that. It's more limited in terms of size of the market, right? So yeah, so we basically almost fully pivoted within a few months to all these kind of types of integration, to just a pure like SaaS property management softwares, like a few solutions within the property management software umbrella to just help hotel with the software solutions. And after what happened, so after I left, the company still continued and was acquired by Yanoj, which is the number one OTA and travel unicorn in Korea. Back then, they had 80% of the OTA market in Korea, so pretty solid. And yeah, and they basically integrated Zen Rooms. So Zen Rooms as a brand don't exist anymore, but now it's part of Yanoja Cloud that has HQ in Singapore and that is distributing software, property management software across Southeast Asia and beyond.
Amazing. What was your key learning about the Zen Rooms and hospitality experience? What are some things that people don't really understand about that approach?
Well, I think that there are a lot of learnings. I think like there are different questions maybe around the management, around the industry in particular. I think the first thing is, and that's the beauty of strategic consulting, the most important is driving the right approach, the right mindset, and the right methodology to solve problems, to identify problems and solve them. So when I came, I had no background in the hospitality industry, but I was still able very quickly to help and provide value to the team, grow the team, build the business, because you can use the tools that you learn in strategic consulting to different industries, including hospitality, and this proved to be the case. And actually, something very interesting to me that I discovered is that, especially when you're not looking at super technical roles, which obviously either you know or you don't know the Python sub-language for this web application, attitude really eats previous knowledge for breakfast. So if you have like very, if you hire very smart people that are driven and that want to learn and grow and build a business, they will perform very quickly. They will perform much better with someone with, okay, X years of experience in the industry, because they have much more drive to learn fast. And also they have seen other things. And actually, when you're in startups and you're trying to solve problems in innovative manners, many times you just cannot do it the way the main incumbents are doing. So when you recruit people from existing hotel chains that are used to all the process and system from big companies, usually it doesn't work because they expect the level of support that they don't get. They are not used to having high level of autonomy and being empowered in decision making. And they don't really think outside of the box because they're like, oh, that's the way it should be. And that's it. Whereas if you hire someone from other industry that have different things to compare it with and that are really focusing on the problem solving rather than just rolling out a solution that they have seen has worked in another environment, yeah, that's really powerful. So yes, that's some learnings that I had. But I mean, I'm sure we'll speak about others throughout this discussion.
And it's interesting because you were the managing director, which is, I think, the equivalent of a general manager role as well. Can you share a little bit more about what it was like? Because previously you were a strategy consultant at Roland Berger / strategy, and then you had various companies. But I'm just kind of curious, what does the GM role for you have to handle?
So first of all, the common point with strategic consulting is that, and especially at the beginning when you're starting a new mission with a new client, right, you really need to deep dive and learn as much as you can on the industry, on the company, looking at all the documents you can put your hands on and then just learn. So that's very similar in a way from the strategic consulting. The difference of strategic consulting is then once you've done all your analysis, your research and your analysis, you just hand it over to someone else to take care of it. In this case, once you've done all the analysis, you also implement it yourself, which is like super really empowering and exciting, to be honest. I mean, the layer that you have on top is really people management. And so that I had the chance, and that's also one of the reasons why they trusted me to take over these responsibilities and grow the team from around 10 people to almost 40 people during my tenure in Zen before we actually downsized. But I had, I was an officer in the French army. I've done the equivalent of West Point or Sandhurst in France. And so managing as a lieutenant, managing like teams also of 20 to 30 people on the field for different types of military operations. Also being capital of my basketball team when I was in Sciences Po. So actually that's basically the strategy piece and the kind of people management skills that I had developed in the army and in sport. I think bringing the two together was like basically the MD role, right? And also, I think there is a personality aspect, right? Some people, they will be super good at focusing on one thing and just diving down on it forever and being the world expert on it. And that's not my personality. And I think that's not really the personality of good managing directors, because you need to have the curiosity and the mental flexibility to constantly jump between different people, different tasks, different problems, different departments, from marketing, operation, sales, account management, doing analysis of your P&L, calling a client that's unhappy. And so you have to have this adaptability and this flexibility on top of the people management skill. Obviously, people management skill also include this aspect of flexibility, but it's more like really, and that's something indeed you have less in consulting, especially as a junior consultant, but like really going to understand what are the motivation and the needs of the people that you work with, whether it's your employees, whether it's the people you're going to recruit, your investors, your bosses, right? And the clients as well, the hotel partners, basically mostly working with like owners or managers of independent hotels, right? So really trying to, what are their needs and how that can fit with what you have as capabilities for your company.
And then after that, you chose to work at Flash Coffee, which was very popular as both from a consumer perspective in terms of coffee, but also popular in terms of like the startup economic buzz, right? So Flash Coffee and Kopi Kenangan and so forth, and Pickup Coffee now. Could you share a little bit more about why you decided to join Black Coffee?
Yeah. First, a disclaimer. I think it got popular after I came in, and not only me, of course, a lot of very talented people joined the company. But I think when I joined, which was in April 2021, it was not that popular. It just had its Series A, and it was not doing that well. I mean, there were good stores doing well, like in Singapore, actually, and Thailand. Indonesia was actually the worst market and doing very poorly, actually, and quite concerning. So from the day one, the approach was like, okay, you know, you take over. The founders were moving to Singapore because it's the headquarters from investors perspective for growing the business regionally, as was the plan. But so you just take over Indonesia and you need to turn it around pretty quickly because it's not doing well. So that was basically the mission. And yeah, I was up for the challenge. And look, we turned Indonesia indeed, like in, I think, as a matter of fact, in the powerhouse of Lush Coffee globally, from the worst performing in terms of both revenue and profit to the best performing, the biggest part of the business. And yeah, both in revenue and in profits within 2 years. So yeah, up to 100 stores almost, mainly the three main agglomerations of Jabodetabek, Bandung, and Surabaya. And yeah, so look, I think it was in different markets, but indeed, and we had the same brand that was really helpful, as you said, from creating really a Southeast Asian or even Asian phenomenon around flash coffee. But there was a lot of local autonomy in each market because the type of clients that you have, the types of expectations, the type of consumption is very different market to market. And happy to share more about that. But yeah, it's you really needed and what made like the good successes of Flash across different locations. It's really this mix of having certain negotiating power, certain systems that you can implement regionally, but also being really open to give autonomy to the markets to achieve at their local country level.
Could you share what were the differences that you saw in the market within Flash Coffee?
Yeah. I mean, differences on many things. First of all, maybe most importantly, differences in terms of customers and customer behavior. So typically, for instance, during the coffee business, for the type of drinks and food that people want and that people like is very different. So for instance, yes, you can have the key classic elements across market. Okay, everywhere you've got to have the Americano and the cappuccino and these kind of things. But apart from that, it can be a totally different portfolio of products in each market in terms of market share, right? So in Indonesia, for instance, very high, most of the vast majority of the sale are in iced product. So between 80 and 90% of the sales on iced coffee. In some markets, it's actually majority hot. So this is a small example, but it has a lot of implications in terms of logistics, in terms of delivery, in terms of storage in the stores. So every small thing has a lot of implication. But yeah, so that's an example of the type of drinks that are most popular, what type of ingredients, what type of importance of, let's say, the milk component in the mix, right? And also when you speak of, so that's the product side of the customers, but also in customer journey in each market. So if you look at Indonesia, it's a lot of, okay, we have relatively cheap delivery, very solid delivery players that were also pretty aggressive in growing in the Indonesian market. So we had, during COVID and even after, a vast majority of our sales online, so which means it's really about how you optimize for delivery in Indonesia. In Hong Kong, for instance, totally different customer journey, right? People are actually walking a lot, are taking all these massive, there is very high density of population, all these massive metro stations and commuting where people are walking around. So what they want is really to pick up, to order on the app, and then when they pass by the station before reaching their office, they just pick up their coffee. This is a very small piece in Indonesia because people will just want to order it and just receive it at their office or at their home. So this has a lot of implication in terms of how you build your business, how you strategize on your real estate approach, on how you build your end-to-end when basically customer servicing. So that the first difference is across customers when in terms of products, when it comes to customer journey, this is quite key. And then I think we also, beyond the customers, pretty much anything has difference between countries when it comes to managing a team, like cultural aspects of like how people work, what are the way people work, the way people collaborate in the different markets. For instance, what I found really, and that's also the team that we wanted to build in Indonesia, but it's also, I think there is an Indonesian factor here. And Jakarta is called Kota Kolaborasi, the city of collaboration. And that's true, actually. Like Indonesians, I find, and especially compared to many other markets, even more maybe outside of Asia, but even within Asia, are very collaborative people, open to help each other, to support each other. Well, there is always a certain degree of competitiveness in business with great ambitious people. But I think it's really from what we experience Flash Coffee, really healthy competition and really good collaboration between people, which means you enable, you know, very good communication lines and very virtuous support versus working, being more rigid. In some cultures and some locations, maybe people are a little more rigid when it comes to, okay, what's my job description? I'm going to fit my job description. If it's slightly out, I'm not going to move from that. So in this sense, I found Indonesia a very startup an entrepreneurship-friendly nation, people that have the right type of mindset for problem-solving, in the sense that it's a country very diverse with a lot of different languages and origins and 6 official religions and all that. So I've not seen like an Indonesian telling me there is only one way to do something. It's okay, they are aware that there are 10 ways to do something, and if the first one doesn't work, they would go for the second one, and etc. And in some other maybe countries, that's a little more of a one-way monoculture and mono kind of risk when you're managing teams from a cultural perspective.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that you have experience in both Indonesia and Malaysia, right? So could you compare and contrast? Because for a lot of folks, they feel like it would be very similar because they both speak some form of Malay. That's one version of it. But how would you contrast the difference or similarities between both countries?
I mean, you've really got a point. There are definitely a lot of similarities. So a lot of the reasons why I like Indonesia or Malaysia was similar for both in terms of being very diverse culturally, religiously, very positive, energetic, friendly people in both cases. There are also differences. Okay, I mean, for instance, I think Malaysia is much more Anglo. There is a much higher, let's say, over average proficiency in English and much more westernized in terms of a little bit, maybe more like Singapore in terms of exposure to Anglo-Saxon culture and language, which Indonesia has more of a local influence. I almost didn't practice my Malay in KL because the Malay, they would rather speak English. Whereas, I mean, obviously in Indonesia, like most of people in startup and all that, they speak good English, definitely, but there is much more keenness and much more practice of the actual underlying local language of Bahasa Indonesia. So yeah, that's one. And look, I think in terms of market-wise, it's very different cities and density of population. So in terms of business, you have to have a different approach. I mean, Malaysia, basically the entire population of Malaysia across Western Peninsula, Eastern Malaysia, it's around 30 million. So which is basically the agglomeration of Jabodetabek. So Jakarta agglomeration is basically the entire population of Malaysia. So you have different dynamics in terms of density of population and hence possibilities of really growing a business to a really solid scale, even staying in like one city, for instance, right? So that's one of the interesting differences.
I think what's also interesting is that Malaysia's GDP per capita is about twice that of Indonesia. So Malaysia is about 12,000 for last year. Indonesia is about 5,000. So how does that show up from your perspective?
Yeah, I was also in different industries. So yeah, hospitality versus, you know, so bigger tickets for end customers to book a hotel versus book a coffee. But yeah, definitely, I mean, there is a higher price sensitivity in Indonesia on this side, right? So you are much more careful about price changes. You have different challenges as well, let's say on the logistic side. So more mature market, more developed market like Malaysia, right? The infrastructure are more predictable and then maybe overall, I mean, higher quality versus Jakarta. You have, especially when it comes to logistics and for us, delivering coffee across different parts of even the city and how do you maintain the cold chain, making sure that the delivery of products is always within the healthy and from a food safety perspective, always top notch. And so, yeah, for instance, this has been a little more work that we had put into to ensure that. Yeah, so that's some of the differences. And I think related to, and I think that's an interesting one as well, like to some extent, I think in less developed economies per capita, there is a higher entrepreneurship mindset because you really have to hustle to make it happen, to survive. And versus more developed economy where you have much more people that are within this kind of, I mean, whether like welfare state or even like private company, but where you have much more security in your employment and less incentives to innovate, to take risk, because why should you take risk? You're already set in your job. So I found that obviously, like I had amazing teams that are very innovative entrepreneurial in both countries, but I would say it's easier to find in Indonesia than in Malaysia, in the sense that in Malaysia, there were still less people that were interested by working for a startup. I mean, first, the pool of applicants is lesser because it's a smaller country, so its talent pool is smaller, but also you had more people that you had to convince, and actually even the great people that I had to convince them, I had more work to convince them at the beginning to join a startup, a company that is risky, that is growing fast, that is new. People, you need to do more pedagogy on that. In Indo, I think that they directly get it. Like there are many of, like I think a bigger pool of the applicants there, they're already excited by that. And you can see in their mindset that they have the kind of more entrepreneurial mindset in nature because maybe the size of the informal economy as well in less developed countries that you have to be an entrepreneur by default in these circumstances.
Amazing. And then obviously, you know, flash coffee has been interesting, right? So we've seen the rise of pickup coffee in the Philippines. We've seen Kopi Kenangan continue to grow. Unfortunately, flash coffee has run into some headwinds. So there was the wind down of the flash coffee Singapore operations and then the sale of the flash coffee Thai business unit to, you know, kind of like a turnaround private equity slash VC fund. Could you share a little bit more about what do you think has happened?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, disclaimer, like, when both of these events happened, I had already left the company to launch Upwork. But yeah, I mean, I think what happened to Flash Coffee in many ways is not unique. It's quite representative of what happened since end of 22 in the venture capital market, and with the specificity that the approach of Flash Coffee had been to fully manage the experience of their customers A to Z and to fully build the stores by themselves. Zero franchise, 100%. So it's not owning the place, but it's taking leases and really do all the construction, building the store and do everything in-house. So which means it's quite capital intensive, right? When you take a lease, depending on the country, but you need to pay upfront and for a few, you know, sometimes 2 years in advance or these kind of things, right? So basically high capital intensive VC business. And we actually were expecting very high amount of capital to come very quickly. And we had actually term sheet signed by major investors globally for very high amounts of investment. And unfortunately, several times the investors that had signed the term sheet went out, not for things related to Flash, but more related to the overall market, which again, don't think it was something unique. Like, I'm sure other companies have experienced it. But what is the impact of that is that you have way less capital than what you need for a portfolio, especially where you are in many markets, right? Across Asia and Southeast Asia. And I think that's one of the good things that, like Kopikenongan or other players that were more focusing on only one market, probably have been less hit because they didn't have this more capital intensive structure. And also you have to understand, like, when you're building a chain, you have economies of scale, which are at the group level, but mostly, to be honest, is economies of scale at the country or city level, which means you really need to get to a certain threshold to make it profitable, I mean, efficient and profitable within the market. And so the smaller countries that were less, with less stores, basically, they were expecting to reach the threshold based on the new big amount of investment that didn't come. And so basically the founders had to decide to how do I allocate the capital that I have, knowing that I have much less than what was planned. And then it totally makes sense to decide which countries do I focus on that are bringing more revenue, that are bringing more profit, but also that have basically already reached the threshold of economies of scale that can enable them to really succeed with relatively low capital versus the ones that are in different situations. So that's why I think, I mean, the closure of Singapore was based on the performance that the market was doing compared to obviously the other markets of Flash. And so I think, you know, even though it's obviously tough and sad for the team and employees and also for the clients in Singapore that were loyal to the brand, but yeah, they had to close that. And yeah, Thailand, I think, which was not the most performing either, having an external acquisition that enables the brand and the people to keep working and keep providing value to customers, I think it's a good thing. Yes, up to now, at least in Indonesia, the business has still been running. There had been a few adjustments along the way, but yeah, the brand is still around and doing well. And yeah, let's see what's to come in the, you know, coming months and years we'll be following.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that you decided to become a founder yourself now. Mm. Could you share a little bit more about why you decided to make that jump?
Yeah, I think that was something that I've always made clear with my employers in the startup world in the last 5 years. So not a surprise in a sense. I mean, timing can always be a surprise, especially as Indonesia was going well. So I remember when there were the articles about me launching Upwork and Flash Coffee, that just after Flash Coffee announced its Series B and all that, they were like, oh, that's very shady. What is this person leaving at this point? You know, but actually it was really not that Flash Coffee Indonesia was doing well, but that was really that it was my personal agenda and career that I was pursuing my overall life goals. And so yeah, as I said, I have always wanted to be in the startup world. I've experienced senior roles in scale-ups in Malaysia and Indonesia. And yeah, the natural next step for me was to experience as a founder, to launch a startup as a founder. That's something I had been thinking for, of course, some time. But you know, you need to find the right people to work with, the right project in the right market. And so that takes time. And I think I didn't want to rush it because I loved my job both in Flash. I learned a lot. But I was also always ready to jump whenever there would be the good opportunity, basically. And so, yeah, that happened. A good friend of mine from university that we met 13 years ago, my co-founder Alex, was basically, he was a McKinsey strategy consultant as well in Sydney, working for Quantum Black as well, the AI branch of McKinsey. He had been right hand of a CEO of a scale-up in Mexico as well, so seen all the scale-up life as a very senior executive there. It's a company doing in the hundreds of millions of dollars in Latam. And so it was also at this point in time, we realized when we had the catch-up that we are both at the point where, okay, look, we have had experience. experience, both in consulting, both in startups at senior executive levels, and that, yeah, the next step for us to really start our own journey and build something and build value for people together. So that's how we start speaking about the project, analyzing the Australian market, where he is as an Australian citizen. And so, yeah, we basically identified Australia as an interesting market, mature market, very different from Indonesia or Malaysia, but on the plus side, which means it's also the right market to start for a solution like ours, where we are a little more about long-term wealth management and helping people navigate their life, their personal financial life. And so we identified that there were like interesting players doing pretty well in other markets like US and Europe, but that there was no player on this in Australia. And we are both like personal finance aficionados, and we thought that was the right moment because also of the legislative changes that were happening in Australia in terms of financial advice and open banking. And so we were basically on a market that was attractive for what we were planning to do, where there was a massive impact that we could bring to start with in this market, and where it was the right moment because of the changes of legislation in different sectors in the financial space. And consequently, I gave my resignation to Flash, and then he also gave his resignation, and we came together mid-May last year in Sydney to build a company with actually a CTO who brings the tech expertise, who is data engineer, software developer that has built massive system for startups and corporates alike in the financial sector, like Moody's Analytics. And so, yeah, who is helping us build the product and the company.
Could you share briefly what Upwork is about?
Upwork is the one-stop shop for personal finance in Australia. So people there can track, plan, and grow their wealth all in one place. Typically, they can know their entire net wealth, their entire assets and liabilities, the personal financial statement on Upwork, and they can follow it live because it's all connected through open banking and other solutions that we have implemented. And once they have a view of their wealth, they can also get insights on what are the potential opportunities to grow their wealth. And we also help them to act upon these insights within the platform, taking the right financial decision, whether it's like investing in a property and taking a home loan or reallocating their funds to increase their returns. All of this is available within Upwork.
Awesome. On that note, could you share about time that you personally have been brave?
Okay, that's a very good question. I think it's interesting, brave and courage. Like, what is courage? I think first, as a disclaimer, I think real courage, like the higher level you can get of courage, maybe as a moral virtue, is probably putting your life in danger to helping others. And I don't think I can qualify for that at this point in time. Yeah. So first of all, it's brave, but within a certain spectrum that I think this is the higher level that you can find. But then what's the other levels, I guess, of courage? I think, and I like the approach of a French philosopher, André Comte-Sponville, who did an analysis of, okay, what are the virtues, the key virtues of human life? And he mentioned he has 15 plus virtues that he's analyzing, and courage is one of them. But it's more than one of them, actually. And what he says is like, courage, or being brave, is the quality that enables any other quality, because it's what makes them effective and real. You can be kind, but if you don't implement this kindness and make the effort and be brave about go and help others or any other quality, or kind or supportive or smart, you can be the smartest person in the world. If you don't make the effort, take your courage in your own hands and use your intelligence for a certain goal in the real world, it's pretty much useless, right? So I do think that courage is the number one quality that you need in life and in startup, and the main differentiator. You have so many clever people out there, but very few that actually have enough courage. And I think courage is a skill at the end. It's a process. So I hope I will grow my courage in the years to come. But I think courage is about pushing your boundaries, basically. Trying to accept that you're going to go in a zone of uncomfort and know that if you want to grow, if you want to build something, you need to go through pain and discomfort. That's the advice of Jensen from NVIDIA as well to Stanford students. I wish you a certain dose of pain. So yeah, pain and discomfort. So example for me, it's a very, not classic, but it's a very physical example, but I think it's a good one. In the sense that when I was in Morocco, I did a skydiving license. From the first jump, it's not like when you are attached to a guy and you just pay and the guy behind you is doing everything. From the first jump, so I did the training on the ground, but from the first jump, I'm actually jumping alone from the plane at 4,000 meters. So at the beginning, there is someone that helps a little for the free dive part where you're going at 200 kilometers per hour, so 55 meters per second down. But then the landing, the opening of the parachute, and all the trip from the moment the parachute is opened, and including the landing from the first jump, you have to do it yourself. And so it's uncomfortable. Like when you're jumping, you are stressed. When you're falling, you're also like, you're trying to catch your breath. And that's what's interesting. Even though I was not scared consciously, I was actually unconsciously, because the proof is that I had issues actually to breath the first jump, like having a panic attack in the jump, even though I was not expecting it. And so your body reacts to kind of extreme environments like that. Still was able to manage and land by myself from the first one. And then I realized this from the second jump totally disappeared. So by pushing your boundaries, you're really becoming a better person, a next level person. Just like when you're in the gym and you cannot do this weight, and then the next time it becomes easy, right? So yeah, my advice is that courage is a muscle and it needs to be practiced basically every day. And what does it consist of essentially is going out there and accepting that you, like, confronting yourself to pain and discomfort, obviously not in a sadomasochist way, but more in a productive way. But don't worry, for pretty much everything that you need to achieve, it will be there along the way as a needed step. So better learn to live it and to practice. The best way to learn is to practice, right?
On that note, I'd love to summarize the three big takeaways I got from this conversation. First of all, thank you for sharing about why you chose to work with Rocket Internet and Zen Rooms in Malaysia. I thought it was a fascinating discussion about the hospitality, but also I think the strategy behind whether to, for example, lease out rooms versus franchise versus white label. And I think it was an interesting subset of also that overall pandemic, you know, apocalypse that happened, right, on the hospitality industry. But it was also a great insight into how you thought about the general manager role, and I think the transition from a strategic management consultant to the founder and general manager dynamic, they hired a team and think about building and getting up to speed on the industry. Secondly, thanks so much for sharing about Flash Coffee and about what you learned about building the Indonesia market. Again, a very good overview about the business model. But more importantly, I think the consumer behavior differences at a market level between Indonesia, Singapore, Thailand, and Hong Kong. I also found it fascinating to hear about, you know, your perspective on the economics of the business versus the global tech, as we saw, liquidity availability for VCs. And I think what are the consequences for companies who are making that trade-off on that. Lastly, thanks so much for sharing about how courage is a muscle. I really enjoyed your point of view about how courage is a virtue that enables other virtues. And you shared about it multiple ways. I think you shared about it in the context of your own experience learning to skydive, but also in your own experience choosing to be a general manager, choosing to work in Malaysia, choosing to work in Indonesia, and choosing to be a founder again after your two GM experiences because you felt like the time was right. So on that note, thank you so much, Maxime, for sharing.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy. It was a pleasure to chat.
Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. We would also appreciate you leaving a rating or review. Head over to www.bravesea.com for member content, resources, and community. Stay well and stay brave.